I wonder if you've ever heard the story of the former Archbishop of Canterbury who was visiting the United States. And as he stepped onto American soil, he was quickly surrounded by an eager group of reporters. And among the many questions that were thrown at him was this one. Are you going to visit any nightclubs while you are in New York? Well, to that the Archbishop replied with a twinkle in his eye, are there any nightclubs in New York? And the next morning the eye-catching headlines of the newspapers ran, Archbishop's first question, are there any nightclubs in New York? How easy it is, friends, to be misrepresented. Now, if that was so for an archbishop in our time, how much more was it for Jesus in his time? Right from the beginning of his ministry, Jesus was misrepresented by the religious authorities of his day, the scribes and the Pharisees. They were scandalised by the way Jesus healed on the Sabbath, fraternised with sinners, and broke the traditions of the elders. They accused him of being a theological liberal, of having no regard for the law of God as revealed by Moses in the Old Testament. And not only this, but he was also leading his followers astray. How is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not, they asked. But here in this famous Sermon on the Mount, we see Jesus' rebuttal of these accusations. In these early verses of our passage, rather than coming to destroy the law and the prophets, he says in verse 17, I have not come to abolish them or destroy them, but to fulfil them. These laws have all their true meaning found in me and through my kingdom, says Jesus. And rather than doing what many people do today, picking and choosing which parts of God's law they'll obey, Jesus says in verse 18, I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until all is accomplished. And rather than the standards of his kingdom being somewhat inferior to the standards of his critics, he tells his disciples in verse 20, I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. And it's this last point that I want to focus on today. For here in these words, we see the very essence of what it means for us to live out our lives as followers of Christ. And friends, it has all to do with our hearts. For true righteousness, according to Jesus, is not one that merely conforms to an external set of rules and regulations. If anybody did that, it was those Pharisees. They had calculated that in the Old Testament there were 613 rules and regulations that they needed to keep. And many of them could say they had kept them all. Paul in Philippians 3 says, as for legalistic righteousness, I was faultless. But Jesus says to his disciples and to us, that is not enough. It's not about legalistic righteousness. True righteousness, the righteousness of my kingdom, is deeper. It is a righteousness of the heart. And as we see in our passage today, Jesus gives three examples of what he means about this righteousness of the heart. In the areas of murder, adultery, and divorce. And friends, his call to us as his disciples is a tough call. It's not just a case, he says, of no murder. It's a case of no hateful thoughts. It's not just a case of no adultery. It's a case of no lustful looks. And it's not just a case of only being married until we get tired of it. It's no disposable relationships. Well, let's look at each of those three examples in turn. First is verses 21 to 26. No hateful thoughts. Look at those first two verses, 21 and 22. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Now you might note here that in each of the three examples that Jesus gives, he begins by saying, you have heard that it was said, and then he concludes, but I tell you. In each case, Jesus takes up something that the scribes and Pharisees had said about the law, their own limited interpretation of it, done in such a way as to make the law less demanding, and he then explains how this law is fulfilled in his kingdom. And we see it here. The sixth commandment that God had given Moses was indeed, you shall not murder. And as with many people today, the scribes and Pharisees thought that as long as they had actually not committed the physical act of homicide, they had kept that commandment. But Jesus sees the commandment as going deeper than this. It's also about how we think about other people and what we say to them. It's not just murder that will lead to judgment, says Jesus, but all those feelings of anger towards fellow Christians and those words that flow from that anger that instead of building each other up, tears them down and treats them with contempt. Raca, you idiot, you fool. And for a Christian to treat others like this, says Jesus, is tantamount to murder. And to persist in it will make you liable for the fires of hell. Well, what do we mean by anger? A young girl was once writing an essay for school, and she came to her father and asked him to define for her the difference between anger and exasperation. The father replied, it's all a matter of degree. And with that he went to the telephone and dialed a number at random. To the man who answered he said, hello, is that Melvin? No, said the man, there's no Melvin here. Why don't you learn to look up the numbers before you dial them? See, said the father to his daughter, that man was not a bit happy with our call. He was probably very busy with something and we annoyed him, but now watch this. And the father dialed the same number again. Hello, is Melvin there? Now look here, came the heated reply. You just called this number and I told you there is no Melvin here. And the receiver was slammed down hard. The father then turned to the daughter and said, that was anger. Now I'll show you exasperation. And he again dialed the same number, and when a violent voice roared, hello, the father calmly said, hello, this is Melvin. Have there been any calls for me? Now, I don't suggest you try that particular thing. But in many ways, it does illustrate that not all anger is necessarily wrong. You could argue that that man was rightly angry at having his time wasted. The Bible does speak of a righteous anger, and it particularly refers to the sort of indignation that we as Christians ought to feel towards those things in our society which are ungodly and unjust. And just as God is angry towards ungodliness and injustice, so ought we to be. But the reality is, on the whole, that's not the case for most of us. When we get angry, it's usually because we're simply hurt. We get jealous. Our expectations have been crushed. We haven't been treated in the way we think we deserve, and our pride gets in the way, and so as a result, we flare up indignantly. Do you remember the story of Cain and Abel? Cain was jealous at God's preference for Abel's offering, and instead of dealing with his jealousy, he allowed it to fester and grow within him until it reached its tragic end. As one old commentator put it, when anger was in Cain's heart, murder was not far off. So it's not just the physical act of murder that counts, says Jesus, but the anger and bitterness and unforgiveness of our hearts, which so often is the cause of physical murder, and which, if left unchecked, will grow like a cancer and eventually destroy us. William Blake expressed this in poetic form. He said, I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. The wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And this is exactly what Jesus tells us to do. To act quickly to put right any wrongs we cause by our angry thoughts or words. Look at what he says in verses 23. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary, who is taking you to court, and so on. Jesus says to us, settle matters quickly. As soon as we are conscious of a broken relationship, we are called to act immediately to put it right. Don't let the sun set on your anger, says the Apostle Paul. And even if we're in the midst of worship, take action. Our worship won't be acceptable with God until we seek immediate reconciliation. Well, friends, can I ask you today this? Is your heart and conscience clear in this regard? Is there somebody that you are at odds with? Someone that you need to be reconciled with? And if so, do it without delay. For if you don't, Jesus' warning is this, that the barrier between you and that person will also become a barrier between you and God. So the first standard that Jesus gives us for those who are to be part of his kingdom, not only don't murder, but don't murder with your words and your thoughts. No hateful thoughts. Secondly, he says, no lustful looks. Verses 27 to 30. You have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now the subject of adultery is never far from the headlines. Today it's a politician. Next week, the captain of a sporting team, and the week after, a well-known radio personality or movie star. And nor is the church immune. Too often we read of clergy, whether Protestant or Catholic, who have committed adultery or some sort of sexual sin. Two of the biggest films in recent times, Fatal Attraction and Indecent Proposal, have centred on the subject of adultery. In 1993, there were over 44,000 divorce cases in this country which had adultery as the so-called proven reason for the divorce. And think of what that means in terms of the pain involved for the people. Spouses, children, parents, parents-in-law, etc. It is a big issue, and sadly to say, one that our own church has not been immune from as well. But as our society makes light of the seventh commandment, don't commit adultery, we see Jesus in these verses giving more weight to it. He's not content with a mere formal adherence to the commandments, but he calls his followers to a radical obedience to the true intention behind it. "I tell you," says Jesus, "that anyone who looks at another person lustfully has already committed adultery with them in their heart." Now Jesus here is not against appropriate sexual desires. He's all for a healthy sexual relationship within a marriage context. What he is concerned about is that Pharisaical attitude which congratulates itself in its external obedience to the commandment not to commit adultery, whilst at the same time seeing nothing wrong with lustful looks and imagination. Just as it's possible, he says, to commit murder in our hearts, so it's possible to commit adultery there as well. I was told the story this week of two Christians who'd gone into a TV studio to give some talks for an interview, when all of a sudden, in walked a tall, beautiful young woman, well-proportioned and stunning to look at. The two men stared at her for quite a while, and then one turned to the other and said, "It's not the first look that's sinful, but the second look that matters." To which the other man replied, "Stop interrupting, I'm still in the middle of my first look." Well, as we all know, the problem is that it's all too easy for the first look to slide into a second look and so on. Remember the story of King David that we had referred to earlier. There he was in his palace on a day when he should have been somewhere else, out with his men fighting a battle. But he decided not to. And there on that day, he went up to the rooftop and caught a glimpse of a beautiful woman, Bathsheba, bathing. He didn't then stop and retreat, but he continued to look. The look turned into lust, and the adultery of his heart quickly turned into an adultery of the flesh, and his life was changed forever. The child of that act of adultery died. His grandchildren quarrelled. His kingdom eventually split into two, all because of a decision to take a second look. As the old saying goes, sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. Now friends, let me assure you that the preacher as he is preaching to himself. As I read recently of all those accounts of President Clinton's immorality, all I could say was this: Lord, give me the grace that I may not so also fall. For I know all too well my weakness in this area. And my question is, do you? Beware of all too quickly saying, "It could not happen to me." For it's so often where we think we are the strongest is where we are actually most vulnerable. Well, Jesus in the next few verses urges us to take extreme action in order to deal with sin. Look at verses 29 to 30. "If your right eye causes you to sin," he says, "gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. If you're being tempted, he says, be ruthless about it. Cut out whatever it is that is causing you to sin. Don't be put at risk, your salvation, all for a momentary pleasure. I like what Don Carson says at this point. He says, we are to deal drastically with sin. We must not pamper it, flirt with it, enjoy nibbling a little of it at the edges. We are to hate it, crush it, dig it out, and do with it as St. Paul urges, put it to death. Now, what will this mean? Well, it will mean different things for different people. Jesus is not giving us here a new legalism. We're not actually to decapitate ourselves as Origen did in the second century and castrated himself in order to avoid temptation. Rather, we are to do all that we personally need to do to put temptation out of our particular way. As the Old Testament says in Job 31, we're to make a covenant with our eyes, so that we will not look where we know we'll be tempted. I recently heard of one member of the PCC who had a particular channel on his TV disabled because of the soft porn it showed late at night. And he said the result was not only earlier nights, but also that his relationship with God had deepened as a result of doing what Jesus said to do. Better to lose one part of the body, in his case a TV channel, than for the whole body to go into hell. So no hateful thoughts, no lustful looks, and finally, no disposable relationships. Verses 31 to 32. It's been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress, and anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. Now this last of Jesus' three examples, of course, is a major topic of itself, and like all the others, is deserving of a sermon of itself. Indeed, if you'd like to consider what Jesus is saying here in more depth, can I encourage you to listen to a tape on those verses only, preached by the Rector Richard Buse and obtainable from the tape library. But let me just very quickly look at what Jesus is saying in these verses. Well, as I said at the beginning, what Jesus is concerned about in all these three examples is to show to his disciples the nature of true righteousness. The way of his kingdom is revealed. And again, we see in these verses the way that the scribes and Pharisees had distorted the teaching of the Old Testament, this time on the subject of marriage. For God's view on marriage is plain. Genesis 2:25, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Malachi chapter 2 verse 16. I hate divorce, says the Lord God of Israel. And yet, many of the scribes and Pharisees had taken a more liberal view. They said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her simply a certificate of divorce. And this was an appeal to Deuteronomy chapter 24 verses 1 to 4, a passage which is basically a prohibition by Moses of early divorce. If a man finds some uncleanness in his wife, Moses said, and if he then gives her a certificate of divorce, and if she subsequently remarries and is then divorced a second time, then Moses said, her first husband cannot remarry her. Why? Well, no one really knows. Was it perhaps as a warning to that first husband that he ought to think very hard about making hasty decisions? we really don't know. But what we do know is that it was certainly not an encouragement to divorce, merely a reluctant concession to a current practice at the time. Jesus in Matthew 19 says that that law of Moses in Deuteronomy was only permitted because your hearts are hard. But the scribes and Pharisees of Jesus' day took it not as a concession, but as a command. They overlooked the broader biblical principles about the need for a marriage commitment to be lifelong and spent all their hours trying to define the meaning of the word uncleanness in Deuteronomy 24. If they could find something which would make their wife unclean, then they'd be allowed to issue a certificate of divorce and dispose of her easily. Some even taught that the wife could be considered unclean and unsuitable for as trivial a thing as serving her husband food that had been accidentally burned. But Jesus insists that the way of true righteousness is greater than that of the scribes and Pharisees. There, he says, are to be no disposable relationships. You see, the focus for those of us who are Christians is never to be, how hard will it have to get before I can pull out of my marriage? Rather, it ought to be, what do I need to put into my marriage to make sure it stays healthy and strong? The fundamental rule for the Christian is that marriage is permanent and divorce should be ruled out. Not because marriage cannot be broken. Many people here today can sadly testify to the reality and pain of that, but because it ought not to be broken. Jesus affirms this with those difficult words in verse 32, and they're tough. He says, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to become an adulteress, and anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. Jesus assumes here that a divorce will likely lead onto the remarriage of the divorced parties. And so strong is he on the permanency of the marriage bond that he claims that the result of a divorce will of necessity mean the breaking of the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. Now, I don't have time here to go into this most controversial and sensitive of topics, remarriage after divorce. Jesus does give an exception which would allow for remarriage. And every pastor I know struggles with how to apply this teaching in as pastoral a way as possible whilst trying to be as true to the biblical principle as possible. But let's be sure that in the midst of the struggles, we do not fall into the same Pharisaism as Jesus accused the scribes of doing in his day. That is, thinking about the grounds for divorce first before we've even discussed the possibility of reconciliation and forgiveness. Let me conclude. No hateful thoughts, no lustful looks, no disposable relationships. Christ's kingdom way, everything the law only ever dreamed of. But how can we live up to this high standard, this righteousness of the heart that Jesus calls us to? As we sit in this room today, we can only too sadly confess that many of us have failed to live up to these standards. We all know of ourselves or others who fail to forgive, who battle with lust and don't seem to mind about it. And we all are aware that the divorce rate amongst Christians and pastors is not really any different from that of society as a whole. The light which is meant to shine, the salt that is meant to be distinctive, is often unrecognisable in society and it doesn't seem to show any difference. But friends, that's not the whole story. For I can point to people in this congregation who, though deeply are seeking to work through their differences, who though are struggling with lustful thoughts, continue to lead faithful lives. I can think of couples in this church who, although their marriage is such hard work, in spite of this, they keep working at their relationship and are determined only to live according to Jesus' ideal no matter what. How can we live up to this righteousness of the heart that Jesus calls us to? I think the place where we need to start is honesty. Honesty with ourselves, for self-deception will get us nowhere. Honesty with God, fleeing to the cross for forgiveness when we've failed. Receiving from Christ the kingdom he offers us, being open to the renewing work of God's Spirit in our lives. Honesty with ourselves, honesty with God, and honesty with each other. For surely God has placed us in a community, a Christian community, a fellowship, to help us be strong at those times when we are so often weak. As Jesus says in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, your words come to us as a hard new way for us to live. But you do not just lay out the law and leave it then for us to do. You provide us through your own Son. You provide us through your Spirit with all that we need to be equipped to live our lives for you. Help us, Lord, to take hold of these words. Enable us, Lord, to serve you faithfully in spite of the struggle. Give us all that we need. Amen.